In her new book about the writer Norman MacLean, Rebecca McCarthy says she met him at the beginning of her adult life and toward the end of his. At this point, she says he had been afflicted by disease and despair. His wife had died. His teaching career at the University of Chicago was coming to an end. McCarthy says for years, MacLean had been working out a story about a family in Montana where a Presbyterian minister taught his sons about God's grace and fly fishing. Of course, this was his own story, and when MacLean was 73, he finished it. The novella, A River Runs Through It, became a sensation and an award-winning film. Rebecca McCarthy is going to join us in a bit to talk about her book, but we wanted to begin with A River Runs Through It. MacLean centers this story on his younger brother, Paul, who was beaten to death in a back alley. For years, he struggled with addictions, alcohol, and gambling. McCarthy says MacLean loved Paul, but he knew he couldn't help him. We asked Mark Matheson to give us some perspective about the story. Matheson is a professor of English at the University of Utah. He's also a fly fisher. And he began with the moment toward the end of the novella, Paul and Norman on the bank of a river.
Paul has not been willing to talk at all about the struggles that he's having and that the members of his family, in some sense, know he is having. And pretty much out of the blue, Paul says, you know, maybe I should leave Montana and go to the West Coast. And Paul contemplates this. He says, I get into a lot of trouble here, essentially. And it's a very brief scene, but there's a pause, and in the next moment he says, I'll never leave Montana. And I like the trouble I get into here. That's the only moment in the book when Paul acknowledges a kind of self-awareness about the trouble he's in. He's very silent about it. And, you know, when he says, I'll never leave Montana, it's powerful, but it's also ominous. It means, you know, frankly, that he's not going to change. He's not going to extract himself from this life of self-destructiveness that, in fact, he's living. Not long after, we come to the moment when the mother and father and the two sons are together for the last time. And Paul and Norman make a point of wanting to go see their aging parents in Missoula and, of course, have the idea of inviting their father out to fish. And there's this moment of hope, hope on the part of everyone in the family other than Paul, and maybe even in Paul himself, that there is a chance for a reversal. There's a chance for a kind of renewal of the family culture. And I think his mother, in particular, dares to think that there's a possibility that they might become a normal family again. And Paul stays a long time after the dinner is over. And then he says, I think I'll just go into town and have a few drinks and see friends. And it's a crushing blow to the rest of the family, particularly to the parents, because they know exactly what it means. There is no recovery now or in the future. And Paul stays out late, and of course he says, don't wait up for me. So that moment, that kind of rising expectation, however doubted by the characters, that, you know, it's possible that all of this will change. It's so beautifully represented by MacLean, and of course, it doesn't happen, and the hope is devastated. And a page later, we learn, you know, that they go off fishing, but not long after, we learn of Paul's death. And I just think that that sense MacLean is able to portray of a family that dares to hope after a kind of long suffering, I think it's a great moment in the book.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about Norman MacLean. Rebecca McCarthy has a new book called Norman MacLean, A Life of Letters and Rivers. She'll join us later in the program. But right now, back to Mark Matheson.
You know, this book was published in 1976. And not because of the book. My family started to fly fish together in the 1980s. And somehow we became aware as a family of A River Runs Through It during that time when we were taking up fly fishing ourselves. And it ever since that time had a kind of central role in, you know, our family's life over the decades. You know, it's a book I go back to with, you know, always great interest, and I'm always moved by it.
For those not familiar with his life or his work, how do you describe his life in writing? I mean, he's known for a few short stories, you know, a few novellas, one book that wasn't quite finished before he died, mm-hmm. Young Men in Fire. But he didn't become known in, outside of his teaching career really until, as you say, it was in his 70s, 73 when he published.
Yeah, book. And I think it's very interesting that he – you know, had that career as a professor at the University of Chicago and decided that he would really focus on teaching rather than publishing academic work, although he published a couple of essays, I think, early on lyric poetry. But I think the text of A River Runs Through It, you know, is helpful here because near the very end of the novella, the character Norman, also the narrator, is having a conversation with his father. And his father essentially tells him to tell Paul's story and not to be reluctant to tell it in a way that involves fictional modes.
Yeah. And take a little license, I guess.
Yeah, take a little license. And but maybe even taking the license will enable you to uncover and reveal the power of the story. And it's a very interesting moment in which there's a kind of, you know, paternal call to Norman MacLean to write his brother's story. And in A River Runs Through It, he talks about how he even starts thinking about writing the story during the course of the events that the novella represents. Yeah. So, yeah.
I want to ask you about the writing itself. The New Yorker writer Catherine Schultz wrote recently that everything MacLean wrote, you could read in a single day, which is true.
Yeah.
But it contains, she says, almost everything there is to know about what the English language can do. How do you describe the way he wrote? It was very spare.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, we may talk later about Protestant theology, which I think is really absolutely crucial to an understanding of the novella, but to MacLean's experience and the experience of his family. But you know, there was a great tradition.
So, but you see them connected.
I do very much,
for sure.
And
okay.
there's a great tradition, you know, coming out of the early modern period in the 17th century, which associates Reformed religion, the religions that were created during the Reformation and the theologies of those religions, with a plain literary style. In our family, there was no clear line between religion and fly fishing. We lived at the junction of great trout rivers in western Montana, and our father was a Presbyterian minister and a fly fisherman who tied his own flies and taught others. He told us about Christ's disciples being fishermen, and we were left to assume, as my brother and I did, that all first-class fishermen on the Sea of Galilee were fly fishermen. I think it's not an exaggeration to say that the kind of, you know, very carefully controlled plain style of MacLean's writing in A River Runs Through It reflects the Protestant tradition that came down to him through his parents and through his father. And in that piece by Catherine Schultz in The New Yorker, she mentions that young Norman would, as a child even, would have to write 3 essays a day under his father's tutelage. Yeah. And his father was a very stern taskmaster when it came to criticizing Norman's writing.
And would throw them away
at the end of the day. And his constant refrain was, it has to be shorter. Make it shorter.
Right.
And so plainer and shorter, because that brings a kind of access to power to language if it's done, you know, gracefully. And MacLean certainly was able to do that. I also think that there are some moments when, you know, MacLean's narrative prose rises really quite suddenly into, you know, sublimity. And, you know, the moment when the great rainbow trout jumps from the water when he's watching Paul fish early in the novel, and the entire world becomes iridescent.
The river above and below his rock was all big rainbow water, and he would cast hard and low upstream, skimming the water with his fly, but never letting it touch. Then he would pivot, reverse his line in a great oval above his head, and drive his line low and hard downstream, again skimming the water with his fly. He would complete this grand circle 4 or 5 times, creating an immensity of motion, which culminated in nothing if you did not know, even if you could not see, that now somewhere out there a small fly was washing itself on a wave.
There are those moments where the discipline of his prose is, you know, the prelude to a kind of, you know, sublime and transcendent evocation of a state of being that, you know, Norman MacLean himself experienced on that river.
The idea of spirituality is kind of shot throughout the novella, don't you think?
Oh, I think so. And, you know, I'm struck by how, you know, the Presbyterian Church is, of course, the Protestant Reformed Church that comes out of the Reformation in Scotland.
Yeah.
And, you know, we get a reference to, you know, essentially on the first page to the Westminster Shorter Catechism, which was produced by the Westminster Assembly during the English Civil Wars. Came out in 1647. And, of course, a catechism is a series of questions used to provide religious instruction to young people. Mm-hmm. And we get the first question, which is, what is the chief end of man?
And we answered together so one of us could carry on if the other forgot. Man's chief end is to glorify God and to enjoy him forever.
That's a really profoundly Protestant perspective. Note that it's not about living a virtuous life to be judged worthy of salvation by the divine at the end of your life. This is not a works-based book. This is a book about a fallen people.
Yeah.
Humanity has fallen utterly. That was one of the major principles of Reformation Protestantism. And to the extent that we rise at all, even in the moment, that is a consequence of the extension of grace to us. You know, I think it's a very powerful paradigm that the Protestant tradition provides for the book.
And then he connects it to fishing in the sense that this is how he puts it in the book. So man, as you say, has fallen from this original state of grace. And so only by picking up God's rhythms,
yes,
were we able to regain power and beauty. And
yeah,
rhythm, art, fly fishing is an art that is performed on a 4-count rhythm between 10 and 2 o'clock. That's God's rhythm.
Right.
They're both connected.
Right, right, right. And note how that remark of Minister MacLean about the, you know, the 4-step rhythm for learning to fly fish is repeated in the book. It's about repetition.
Yeah.
It's about practice. It's about discipline.
It's a catechism.
And it is a catechism. And it is through these steps that we achieve the possibility of experiencing grace. And so I think that's absolutely right. His lesson in fly fishing is embedded in a, you know, larger and indeed Protestant understanding of human experience.
It's interesting, too, the way the word beauty and beautiful, he uses that word throughout. And he says his father, unlike most Presbyterians, he said, used the word beautiful a lot.
I think it's really powerful the way that word is used in this book. And I think that my understanding of it is shaped by this theology of all of us being very fallen but still susceptible to or sometimes touched by grace. And I think that when he describes Paul as beautiful, he recognizes that his son is in so many ways, despite all his problems, a product of grace. And so I think when the Reverend uses the word beautiful, which he does sparingly but very powerfully about his own son, I understand it to be, you know, a kind of attestation on his part to the grace that has gone into the creation of his son and the kind of man he is.
Mark Matheson, he's a professor of English at the University of Utah. We'll take a break, come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. We're talking about Norman MacLean today. Until he was 73, most people didn't know who he was. Then he published a story that some believe is an almost perfect piece of writing. A River Runs Through It was about his family in Montana, where there was no clear line between religion and fly fishing. There's a new book about MacLean that's giving us a chance to revisit the story. Mark Matheson is with us. He's a professor of English at the University of Utah. Let me ask you about the practical aspects of this book in this sense. One of the things that Rebecca McCarthy says in her biography is that A River Runs Through It didn't just emerge in one piece, she said, that over, you know, I think 3 years he wrote many versions of it. And early on, she says, it was a fly fishing manual. Later, it became more about the dynamics of the family and, as she puts it, the limits of love. But at first, it was just about fly fishing. So as a someone who fishes himself, what do you learn about fly fishing from A River Runs Through It?
You know, I think it is and I'm not just saying this because I'm afraid of what Norman MacLean would say to me if he were around, if I said something else. But I think it really is a very thoughtful, accurate, seasoned understanding of how to fly fish that emerges from the novella and right, you know, beginning with you know, that four count rhythm.
Yeah.
If you want to learn how to fly fish, that's very, very important. The Reverend has it right, and he taught his sons well. So from that point on, through the rest of the novel, I think that, you know, it's a very sure guide to, you know, fly fishing technique and the practice of fly fishing.
You know, there's a really beautiful part where MacLean describes how a fly rod is powerful, but it has to be delicate enough to tremble. So that gives you a sense of sort of what you're working with, right?
Right,
but then he talks about how a cast is not about diverting the power, but sort of picturing, as he describes it, this round trip of the line. So you have the line, you have the leader, you have the fly.
Right.
And then he writes about this. This caught my eye, someone who likes to fish, where you, in that process, giving it that little beat of time. So you have to, and your back cast, you have to get that time right,
right,
or it'll be a mess on the front cast.
Yeah.
And so the leader and the fly can catch up to the heavy line. So in I've never seen anything like it in really beautiful literary ways. He's giving you a fly fishing lesson.
He absolutely is. And I think that waiting that one beat when the line is parallel to the earth and behind you, waiting a beat before you bring the line forward in your cast is the absolutely essential thing to do, not only to keep the cast from, you know, coiling up at your feet, but also to get the distance that, you know, is so often talked about in the novella. You've got to get the fly to where the fish are, and that oftentimes means you've got to cast a considerable distance. And if you're going to be able to project the fly, you have to wait.
Yeah.
It's very much about a kind of rhythmic willingness to pause and then to create the right cast.
Remember, as my father kept saying, it is an art that is performed on a four-count rhythm between 10 and 2 o'clock. My father was very sure about certain matters pertaining to the universe. To him, all good things, trout as well as eternal salvation, come by grace, and grace comes by art, and art does not come easy.
You know, fly fishing is never, you know, a crude metaphor for anything in the novel, but it is about how you can take the mess that we are and, sort of find a way to create beauty and to become beautiful. And that's exactly what, of course, the father says about Paul in that last scene where they're fishing together for the last time. And Paul takes all this learning and all this technique and all this discipline and transforms it into an art and into grace. That's a very powerful summation of I think McLean's own understanding about how we might live fruitfully.
I think one of the things that seems to trouble Norman McLean more than anything else throughout the book, when you read about just his life in this biography that we're talking about, is how he could not help Paul.
Right.
And it seems like that is such a theme in the book, the idea of just not being able to help. Do you notice that theme there too?
Oh, I think it's the very heart of the book.
Yeah.
And I think it is what, for me, makes the book so very, very powerful. I don't think it's a book about the limits of love. I think it's a book about the infiniteness of love. But it is a book very much about how one's infinite love for another human being cannot necessarily save that human being from impulses of self-destruction and conditions that person is dealing with that are incompatible with life. And I think that's an aspect of the book. That's the heart of the book, as I mentioned, for me at least. And I think that, you know, that's where the book cuts very close to the bone for so many of us who, you know, have had similar experiences with people whom we love infinitely and that we aren't able to save.
Let me read a section. This is at the evening you mentioned at when they have that dinner. Paul sticks around as long as he can, and then he leaves. And his father said to Norman, "You are too young to help anybody, and I am too old." By help, I don't mean a courtesy like serving choke cherry jelly or giving money. Help, he said, is giving part of yourself to somebody who comes to accept it willingly and needs it badly. So it is, he said, using an old homiletic transition, that we can seldom help anybody. Either we don't know what part to give, or maybe we don't like to give any part of ourselves.
I think that's a profoundly... Well, Protestantism, you know, originated in rereadings of the Apostle Paul. And there's no accident that the son of this, ministerial couple in the Presbyterian Church is named Paul. But remember, Paul talked about love in unforgettable ways, in particularly the 13th chapter of 1 Corinthians. And, you know, sometimes that passage is translated as charity. Sometimes it's translated as love. He's very much building on an idea of love as essentially being defined by self-giving, by the giving of oneself. And we think of charity as giving gifts, right? And in terms of caritas, it is the giving of oneself. And I think that it's interesting to me that Norman Paul's father is you know, not particularly optimistic about being able to help others, but he's obviously thinking very deeply and articulates very powerfully the understanding of love that comes out of Paul the Apostle, where love is defined by self-giving and by the giving of, you know, one's you know, heart and help to others. And so I think that in and of itself is a reminder for the reader of just how imbued with a particular understanding of love the book is.
Would you say something about that last, or one of the last scenes in A River Runs Through It, where Paul has two fish to go to get his limit, catches one, he's got one more, and he makes one last cast, as Norman MacLean writes, one last cast for one last fish. It's a really beautiful moment. Do you want to say anything about that scene?
Well, it is a beautiful scene, and Paul's catching of the fish and playing of the fish is probably described at greater length than any other catch and play in the course of the work. And I think it's, of course, very important that Norman and his father are sitting on the bank watching all of this happen.
Then the shoulder shot straight out, and my brother stood up, faced us, and with uplifted arm proclaimed himself the victor. Something giant dangled from his fist. Had Romans been watching, they would have thought that what was dangling had a helmet on it. "That's his limit," I said to my father. "He is beautiful," my father said, although my brother had just finished catching his limit in the hole my father had already fished. This was the last fish we were ever to see Paul catch. My father and I talked about this moment several times later, and whatever our other feelings, we always felt it fitting that when we saw him catch his last fish, we never saw the fish, but only the artistry of the fisherman.
All of this is a kind of consummation for the family. It's a kind of testament to the possibility that art and beauty can be achieved even by those of us who struggle in a fallen state. And, of course, the father says he is beautiful of his son. And it's just a moment in which not just fly fishing, but art and beauty, both as, I think as instances of grace, as Norman MacLean understood them, come together, and whatever happens to Paul after, and we all have a sense by that point in the novel of what's going to happen to Paul. This is a human being who's achieved something. And in the course of the scene, he ceases to be described as Paul and is described as the man, which is to generalize it and to raise its importance to the level of paradigm and of the realization of human possibility.
One more question, and I ask this to you as someone who I know fly fishes. MacLean writes, "Until a man is redeemed, he will always take a fly rod too far back."
That is true. I say, you're taking it to my back. You don't want to touch the ground with it.
Well,
the tip behind you.
Yeah. Did you figure it out? Are you redeemed? That's
yeah,
the question.
Yeah. Well, I think there's something redemptive about reading the novella. I think there's something redemptive about A River Runs Through It. And I think it's, I think of Paul's mother, who after Paul leaves that night at the dinner, she knows everything. This is a work about how Presbyterian women know everything in Montana in the first part of the 20th century into the mid-20th century. And I think it's really amazing the kind of relationships that our narrator, Norman MacLean, has with his wife, Jessie, and his mother-in-law and sister-in-law. It's quite astonishing, very rich part of the book. you know, what's redemptive about reading the book is how deeply earned, I think, and how convincingly presented the testament to love at the end of the book is, and on the part of the father, on the part of Norman, and on the part of the mother, who doesn't say anything after Paul leaves, does the dishes and walks up, and when she's at the top of the stairs near her bedroom, she says good night. And she walks away when Norman and the police officer come to tell his parents that Paul has been killed. She doesn't say anything. She walks into her room. It made me think of that line in Shakespeare about Cordelia in King Lear, which is a great play about love. And away she started to deal with grief alone. And, you know, Norman says, the narrator says, she seems to have known that simply to have loved Paul was enough. I think we can't necessarily help the people we love, but we can go on loving them.
Thank you very much.
Thanks so much, Doug. I really appreciate your time.
Mark Matheson, he's a professor of English at the University of Utah. When we come back from a break, we'll talk with Rebecca McCarthy about her new book, Norman MacLean, A Life of Letters and Rivers. Back in a moment, you're listening to Radio West.
Support for Radio West comes from our members. Find out how at KUER.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. When Rebecca McCarthy first met Norman MacLean, she was 16. He was 70. They became close friends. He taught her how to fly fish. He taught her about art and good food and the social graces. He taught her about rhythm and harmony and poetry because she wanted to be a writer. And she did. She became a writer, a reporter for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, and her new book is a portrait called Norman MacLean, A Life of Letters and Rivers. McCarthy told us when they first met, MacLean wasn't the literary legend who created A River Runs Through It.
I didn't meet Norman MacLean. I met an old guy, just this old guy who lived in Sealy Lake. And my brother John and my sister-in-law, Marilyn, they had a lot of older friends. And I was very close to my sister-in-law. I mean, she was so cool. She was like 13 years older, and I would send her poems. And she was sending them on to Norman without my knowing it. So my brother wanted me to meet him. And I thought, okay, another old person they're friends with, that'll be great. So when he showed up, you know, he gets out of his Volvo and looks at me and goes, you know, darling, this is a great pleasure. I was like, oh my God, because he just had this presence of a real tough guy. With me, that wasn't his persona, but that's what he looked like, you know? And so he goes, John, you drive. So John and Marilyn and my niece, who was two, they got in the front seat. And Norman and I were in the back seat. The first question he asked me, he goes, Rebecca, darling, what's on your great mind? And of course, somebody asks you that and your brain just empties of all thought, you know? And so I thought, oh my God, I got nothing on my mind. And I said, you know, I don't know. And then he starts talking to me about college and where do you want to go? And so I said, oh, I don't know. I'm thinking about going down the road to Missoula. And Norman's like, no. You know, and then he starts listing schools that he thinks would be appropriate. And he goes, you know, look at these poems. And then I thought, okay. And then he said, it's my poems. And I was just about vomited. I could not believe it. And, you know, he started telling me, you know, this is a great image. This is great. And, you know, this isn't so good. And, you know, just sort of grading everything I had done. And then we start talking about poets I liked and I mean, I kind of realized this wasn't your average old guy. And then he just said, you know, you need to come to the University of Chicago. But I mean, I hadn't been in big cities. And the idea of going to Chicago, you know, it scared me. My sister-in-law, though, had been there, and she was very reassuring. It's like, oh, it's just like a big Missoula, which isn't true. But, you know, her reassurance helped a lot. Yeah, somebody asked me once, did you know when you met Norman that you would write a biography? And I was like, no. I mean, how could you know that? I was, you know, barely 16 years old. Nobody knows that. But you don't know how things are going to work out.
Let me ask you this. When you met Norman, of course, he was in the latter part of his life and in his career. He was, this is how you put it in the book, he was harrowed by disease and despair. But you say that when you were with him, you didn't really think about his age. How do you explain what Norman, what was he like? You say he had this kind of youthful sense of humor and he had this sense of curiosity. What was he like to be with?
You know, you couldn't say anything that would shock him. Hmm. So I guess that word is unflappable. He had more habits than anybody. And that meant that when he was failing, his habits sustained him.
Yeah.
I mean, I knew him from the time he was almost 70. I didn't know from 1 to 70, and that's a lot of water under the bridge.
Yeah.
So I had to learn about him. But what was he like? He was somebody who I enjoyed being with. You know, I thought of him as a friend, you know, a good friend who knew a lot more than I did about the university, about literature, and about Chicago, who had a car. He knew my brother and my sister-in-law and my mom. And Norman was like this, he was like a good friend who just assured me that I could do it. Whatever was asked of me, he assured me I could do it.
Yeah. Talk a little bit about where he was at this point when you meet him, because, you know, at this point his teaching career was pretty much over. You say before he retired, he started to put down on paper these stories that he had heard and that he had told that, as you say, helped him come to grip with his brother's life. So when you first came to know him, he had no idea he would become Norman MacLean. You know what I mean? This sort of literary icon.
No. Alan Fitchin, who edited A River Runs Through It, he said Norman was almost shy. And I would say Norman wrote his first story in there, Logging and Pimping Your Pal Jim. That was the first memory story he wrote. And he just, you know, wrote it out of his head. And he read it to the faculty club, the Stochastics, at the Quadrangle Club. And the way it was advertised, it was complete, you know, Logging and Pimping or Your Pal Jim by Norman MacLean, noted authority. And so, I mean, the place was packed. And Norman read the whole story and people raved about it. And one of the people there was this guy, Don Morris, who edited the alumni magazine. And he said, Norman, you have to write more. You have to. And Norman was like, okay, well, this went well. And his close friends, Ned Rosenheim and Glenn Kolb and Richard Stern and the whole faculty of the English department. And there were people from other departments there in the faculty club. They all just said, Norman, you have to write more. And it kind of buoyed him up, you know, and he thought, yeah, I will.
Yeah. I don't know. It's interesting the way you write about your relationship with Norman. It's clearly conflicted. You say that throughout your friendship with him, just as long as you met his expectations, as long as you were, as you say, developing the best that was within you, then he was okay. But
I think he forgave me a lot of shortcomings.
Yeah,
I know he did.
But you also say that he was not at times, in important times when you're young and you're heartbroken, he wasn't kind or supportive. He wasn't capable of showing empathy.
he was not very empathetic, at least not to me. I'm sure he was to his, you know, daughter who he adored, and her two boys, yes, and to his friend Larry Kenton. Joel Snyder, his son-in-law, told me the only two people who escaped Norman's judgment and kind of disdain at times were Larry Kempton and Jean, his daughter. Everybody else, you know, they had their head chopped off. I think he knew he was sometimes too harsh, but it's like he just couldn't help it. You know, it's that old joke about the frog and the scorpion crossing the river together, and they, you know, everything's going smoothly. The fog is going, the scorpion's riding. They get to the other side, and the scorpion, when they're almost there, the scorpion stings him a million times. And he goes, "Why did you do that?" He goes, "I don't know. It's my nature."
Yeah.
You know, it's kind of like that was Norman's upbringing. He kind of could not help it.
So you mentioned this story. We love this. Gave you a sense of who, what it was like. 1987, some interviewer, I think it was a book editor, asked him this question. I can imagine myself asking this question, by the way. And it, was there a connection between the art of writing and the art of fly fishing? And Norman said, "Well, that's kind of an asinine question, isn't it?"
You know what? Here's what happened to him. Norman made himself a new persona after A River Runs Through It was published. He was Norman McLean, writer, author. And he became kind of very much big-headed, which is what he always cautioned me against becoming. And you would hear these people patronizing him like, "You started writing in your 70s, and it's such a good book." And Norman would, you know, "Why the hell would it not be a good book? Do you not think I know what good writing is?"
Yeah.
I mean, Norman had been turning over the rock of Paul's death and what to do about his family for decades.
Yeah.
So finally, when he kind of relaxed enough to sit down and do it, then, you know, it's great. I have these two friends, George Jensen and Heidi McCauley, she just got married. They wrote a book called Norman McLean, The Search for Beauty. And what it is they got every draft of the story of A River Runs Through It. And they show you how that book came to be. Like, it started out like a fly fishing manual.
Yeah.
Like, this is how you fish. You know, you blah, blah, blah. Your arm goes like this, and it's between 10 and 2 o'clock. So he wrote that, and then he's like, he goes through and he scratches out stuff, and then he puts this here, and he's giving it to the typist to type and marking up the typed copy. And so George and Heidi show you in their book how it came to be. And once he started going, and then he was finished, I mean, I think he just knew. It's great. I mean, he didn't need anybody to tell him that he had written what I believe it's a perfect book.
Yeah.
I don't think you can take a word out. I don't think you can put a word in. What can you do better? You can't.
You watched Norman McLean fly fish. What was it like? How good was he? How do you describe the way Norman McLean fished?
I wrote a poem about it. I mean, it was like, you know, the metronome going back and forth, and then, you know, the line goes out, and then in a little while, he comes up with a fish. I wouldn't say it was like a machine, but I mean, he told me, "This is what you do, darling. You do this, 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 the line goes out, blah, blah, blah. You know, gonna see the fly, and the fish will come and take the fly." And the fish took the fly, and I was like, "My God, this is just what he said was going to happen." You know, and then he reels in the fish, and that's that. It wasn't fancy. Like, I've seen really fancy fly fishermen. You know, they do a roll cast or whatever. Norman's just, you know, doing it like the old man taught him to do.
You know, it's interesting. I wonder what he thought about what he thought of as home, like what he thought about the West. William Kittredge, you mentioned, who's people may know, a writer, a teacher, was a teacher at the University of Montana, asked him, invited him to come to this conference. And the title of the conference was "Who Owns the West?" And it made me wonder, gosh, how did that go? What was his answer to that question? I mean, what do we know about the way he thought of the West? I mean, he seems in some ways to have been formed by the landscape of that place, but Chicago was home. Like, so, you know, what do you make of his relationship with the West, do you think?
Well, you know, he used to say that, you know, Montana has an extraction economy, right? People take the timber, they take the coal, they take the natural gas, the gold, everything is taken. And he said, but the worst loss for Rocky Mountain, for Montana and the Rocky Mountain states, is the draining of its men and women. That people who had gumption and ambition and intelligence left. But I think that Norman thought of, he also thought the West, the writing in the West was too regional. And he encouraged people at, I think it was a talk he gave in Bozeman, to not, you know, to think bigger, and that his favorite accolades came from Jewish girls in Brooklyn who loved the book because they had brothers like Paul. You know, I say, it's terrible to quote yourself. I don't mean to do that. It sounds so vain. But, you know, that book has something for everybody. And so many people with addiction in their families relate to a river runs through it. It's the doomed brother. And there seems to be one almost in every family, maybe not the immediate family, but the extended family. There's always somebody bye-bye-ing in the wilderness who's the black sheep.
Well, he died in August 1990. And you say the cause of his death, that isn't really important to you. I mean, he had all kinds of stuff going on toward the end. He had heart disease and pneumonia and prostate cancer. But you say that cause, that's not really important to you.
It's not important to me.
Yeah, what do you mean? Why not?
Who cares? He died.
Yeah.
I mean, it's kind of like what he used to talk about at Little Bighorn, you know, picking up arrows. I mean, it's like a detail that doesn't matter to the story. The story is the 7th Cavalry got mostly annihilated.
Yeah.
You know, this, for me, the story is Norman died.
Well, you say in the end of his life, he had finally figured out who he was, and that was a storyteller who wrote books centered on tragedy and guided by compassion, which I think is a nice way of kind of, I don't know, not making it too tidy, but saying it.
I think that was true. I think that's how he was and how he would like to be remembered. I think he would also like to be remembered as just a wonderful teacher. I've said this before. I was not the only project, let me tell you. There were other people who were projects. There are other people around the country who Norman, you know, because I could see in the letters, the multiple letters, there was a guy named Art Onan, who taught in England. And Norman just, you know, once he had the, you know, once he had the hook in you, he was going to land you. And he has all these young people who he stayed in touch with his whole life. And that's kind of unusual. He was a phenomenal teacher and a phenomenal writer.
Well, Rebecca McCarthy, thank you very much.
Well, thank you.
Rebecca McCarthy, her book is Norman MacLean, A Life of Letters and Rivers. Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. Also, we're on YouTube at KUER 90.1. We'd love to hear from you. You can email us at radiowest@kuer.org. And join us tomorrow for a conversation about the fate of a Bravenel Hall in Salt Lake City. Where does the beloved concert hall fit into this new plan for a sports and entertainment district? program is produced by Benjamin Bombard and Tim Slover. Carrie Watson is our executive producer. I'm Doug Fabrizio.